Andres is the co-director of the Center for Regenerative Design at the College of Marin. He is the founder and president of EduTrax, which is a firm specializing in green building and sustainability education. He is the author of Sustainability Revolution, A Portrait of a Paradigm Shift, which I recommend all of you read. And most importantly, he is an active and knowledgeable member of our home community here. So.
Thanks, Pam, and thanks, Greg. And I really want to extend my appreciation to both Greg and the team here at Green Fusion and Pam for what she's doing at Sustainable Fairfax. Greg, because I think what they're doing here is almost like a new model, a new business model, because they're incorporating learning communities with their businesses. And I think the more we can start doing that in our local businesses, the more we'll get community members involved in all of the things that so many of us care about. And Sustainable Fairfax, same thing. I think there's so many groups here in the Bay Area, but across the country, that are trying to find ways not only to educate, but to get people involved, education and action. And I think those go hand in hand. So good work, and I'm really happy to see all of you here tonight. So Pam said to me, you know, I want you to do a Sustainability 101. And I said, okay, how do we start that? Well, it just so happens that I kind of started doing that when I was doing my master's thesis work at New College of California. And for my thesis, which turned up being this book, The Sustainability Revolution, was really a map of the global conversation of what's happening around the world in sustainability. And the way I looked at it, the way I drew the contours of the map, if you will, is by looking at the various principles of sustainability. The principles are these declarations that come either from individuals or organizations. They come out of conferences, they come out of books, and they are really the value set. And I thought that that might be a great way to begin to understand what the values are in sustainability on a worldwide level. So they extend from local principles, be it, you know, city, town, to regional, to state, to national, and to global. They're all across the board. But let's start with an even bigger picture. And I love this quote of Albert Einstein, because I really believe this is what we need to do, is to completely start thinking of new ideas and to not be afraid of making mistakes. You know, so often in education we're taught about getting the right answer. Well, we need to be so confident of trying new things that we feel okay if we err 9 times out of 10. Because out of the one time that we do get the right answer might be the solution that we're looking for. And I think that quote, to me, that's what that quote really talks about. So when we start looking at a worldview, I think of Dana Meadows. Dana Meadows is an environmentalist that did work at, in the East Coast. And she was very big on systems theory. And in systems theory, you look at systems, you look at the big picture. And the first thing to be focusing on is a vision, what the values are, what the guidelines are, what the frameworks are. So often, if we get caught up in looking at the numbers, at the budget of things, we shortchange ourselves because we let that guide our process. If we're able to think of the vision, take Sustainable Fairfax. If we have a vision for what Fairfax could be, then we can strive towards it. If we say to ourselves, we only have $100,000 and we got to make it happen, then that's what's going to drive the design. So in order to design the design process, we need to think of the guiding principles and of the vision of what we want. And then we work towards it. So we start, and that's why this is the biggest circle. Then we go to the mental models. The mental models are where we're able to see the connections and the relationships. And I'm convinced that in education, we have to get away from silos. We have to get away from disciplines, and we have to start looking at the ecotones, the threads between the disciplines, because that's where the answers are. And that's what we're starting to do in education now in some of the more innovative programs. Then we go to the process. How do we integrate those ideas and those connections and relationships? Then we get to the tools, which are things like the ecological footprint, the carbon footprint, all of the metrics and tools that we use to see where we've been, where we are, to measure things. And then we have the products, which are the techniques that we use. Now, oftentimes, we do this in reverse. We start with the products, and then we find out, oh, how does this fit into the principles of the vision? It's backwards. I think this is the most important, to start up here and then work our way down. And because these will adapt to the larger vision. So some of the global trends, let's look at four of them. One is population growth. So we're at 6.5 billion people right now. We're supposed to level off at around 9, maybe 10 or 11. Say 9 is sort of the gauge that tends to be thrown out there. There's some good news in that front, in that in some developed countries like Russia and like Italy and other formerly Eastern European countries, the population is actually in a decline. And we also know that a lot of the solutions in dealing with population growth has to do with education for women in developing countries. The other side of the coin is, of course, that we're still dramatic rise in population. I mean, population in California is due to double in, I think, 25 or 30 years, something along those lines. So we have to get ready for what that means in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of food, in terms of transportation, all of that. Species extinctions, again, that's all due to population, resources, loss of decline of ecosystems. Then we have oil and gas liquids. This is the famous Hubbard curve, when we see, you know, where the U.S. peaked in 1970, and here's the peaks of all the other countries. So basically, we're in this time period where we're in this transition, and energy is going to play a huge role in how we get through that transition. And, you know, how do we come up with solutions that are going to be viable and are going to work and make it a smooth transition? The last graph, I just grabbed that, which reminds me of Al Gore's graph, that huge graph from his movie, Inconvenient Truth, looking at the impact of temperature and CO2. And again, we go back 400,000 years and we see where we are, that dramatic rise in carbon dioxide and in temperature. And finally, the discussion is not if it's happening, it's like it is happening, so how do we deal with it? And that is a good shift. This is, I always like to look at data, not just in charts and graphs, but look at, this is almost like the DALI version of world fuel use, of looking at the U.S., looking at South America, Africa, and so who are the big consumers of fuel? It's a great source, it has all kinds of maps like this on all kinds of factors. But again, we see India and China, the U.S. and Europe, again, the North, if you kind of divide the world in Northern and Southern Hemisphere, as being the biggest consumers of that. And then if we look at the per capita carbon dioxide emissions, this is really interesting. It's in metric tons. And we see the U.S., again, on a per capita basis, which is important because, we have 300 million people, but individually, how are we consuming, which speaks directly to our lifestyle. And then you have India, the opposite end, and China, kind of which has much larger populations. But again, on a per capita basis, they're a lot less than we are. China is due to surpass, on a country basis, the greenhouse gas emissions that we have right now in about 2 years. That's the extent of their growth. We were thinking that it would take about 8 to 10 years, but it's actually going to happen in like 2 years. That's the rate of growth that China is going through right now. And in the U.S., greenhouse gas emissions, again, a lot of it is in the energy sector. And within that, I think it's like 27% that's within the transportation area of energy. Agriculture, you have about 6% waste and industry. This graph, this is from that report that came out about 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, the Stern review that was done in England. I don't know if some of you may have seen that or heard about it in the news. It was a big thing in the news about looking at really the impact of climate change. And here we see from the shift in centigrades as it goes up, and then in terms of food, how the crop yields, the impact on crop yields, in water, decrease in water availability, ecosystem, the damage to coral reefs and other areas, and then what the extreme weather events are going to do. And basically that report, which is available online, just says unless we really start acting now, it's going to be dramatic impacts on the global economy much later. So it really points to the seriousness of what this climate change issue that is now sort of finally getting in front and center, why we need to focus on it, what we can do about it. And here we see some other data in terms of what we've seen in terms of floods. Here the dramatic rise in floods in the different continents from 1950 to the year 2000. Look at the spikes in every continent. Wildfires. I mean, we can see it in the news and the events of wildfires and tsunamis, but here's sort of charted how it's spiked in all of this. This is all from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which is a great report that kind of looked at all these world trends. So when we speak about sustainability, I have three definitions up here. One is more on sustainable development, and you know, in a sense, I almost feel it's more important for each of us to come up with our own definitions that make sense for each one of us in our lives. I mean, this is important because it points to a general overview, and it maybe the current theme here is the fact that it's our place in the world and the role of future generations. So it's not only the human species, but it's the human species in relationship to all other species, and then how do we go forward into the future, and what's the future of, you know, 7, 10 generations into the future. Bill McDonough just keeps it real simple, you know. The first one is pretty bureaucratic. Mine is more in the principles and dealing with ourselves and then the ecosystems. Let's see if we can. Let me go back a little bit here. I think I'm going back. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, I know why that happened. It's a big file, so it'll go. So this is just some of the big stories that have come out in the mainstream press over the last year. And interesting story about Vanity Fair that I heard was that as soon as it came out, that the magazine was actually pulled out early because it was considered a little too radical for that, so it was only out there for like a few days. I had a bunch of friends that said I wanted to get it and they didn't see it, and they put out the next issue early. But the good news is that it did make it into the mainstream magazines. Vanity Fair, Time Magazine, that was a famous one. Economist has had since then other articles related to sustainability and the state of the world. Newsweek, and of course Al Gore's movie. And Al Gore is actually doing a bunch of trainings now in different cities. To train people to then get that message out to schools and to other community groups, which is a great idea of what he will be doing. So in transportation, some other sort of trends that are happening. Bicycle production keeps going up, which is really interesting. When you think about China and you hear that they're just going into the automobile, well, it turns out that a lot of cities now in developed countries are pouring money and plans into developing bike lanes. Marin County got a grant, a federal grant, one of like five cities, I believe, that got that to start developing our own bike pathways. Hybrid car sales, 17,000. This is just for the last 2 years, you know, per month total. And again, as Toyota has a plan to do all of their fleets to be hybrid. And when I think about that, I go back to R&D, because it was Toyota who, you know, 20 years ago decided to invest in research and development, funded in part by the government, to say, you know, we don't know where this is going, but let's start researching and pouring investments into new technologies. We did it here in this country with respect to the web, right? Because the original development of the internet was ARPANET, which was a military development in case we got nuked and they needed to communicate with each other. And that eventually spawned into the early adoption, which then evolved into what we have now as the World Wide Web. But that was early investment by the government into a technology which was research and development, not applicable per se. So I think that it's valuable to think about how we can invest in basic research. And Japan is famous for doing that and has reaped the rewards of that. In wind technology, we see that the capacity has gone way up, and the cost and the price of wind is now competitive with fossil fuels. And again, another technology that was sort of spearheaded here in California in the 70s, and then the Europeans took it, particularly Denmark, and started implementing their wind technology, and now they're the leaders in the world, and they're the Dutch and other European countries. In this country, I think it's starting to come back now, but again, the government has lots of incentives in Europe to promote wind technology. Solar, same thing. Japan has now surpassed us, so they're actually producing more solar panels than we are. And there's a lot of talk recently about these solar collectors that concentrate the sun's rays. I don't know if you've heard about that, but that's a whole new technology now that they're looking at as a way of using less area per panels and being able to focus the sun's energy into fewer panels. And so they're looking at that as a new source. This is a graduation pledge that the bigger story here is education, but this is a pledge that many colleges and universities have now taken, students are taking, as a way of saying when they graduate, they want to work for socially responsible organizations. The bigger story is that there's a revolution happening in higher education and in college campuses and universities. And it's starting all the way from academics to facilities to the food production at all levels, from the College of Marin to Dominican to liberal arts schools to larger universities. There was just the first annual conference in Tempe, Arizona last month, which got together all of the colleges and universities, and the people involved in greening their campuses went down to Tempe. And just to share stories and share ideas of what's working and what's not and how to get students involved. And many of the initiatives in universities are actually spearheaded by students, where they, for example, decide, what if we just have students pay an extra $5 in their tuition fees and use that money to start a program? A lot of schools have done that, and it's really worked well. This is Green Building, another huge transformation that's happening in that industry. Actually, this week, this whole week is the national conference in Denver, the U.S. Green Building Council. So the U.S. Green Building Council is a nonprofit that started in the early 90s and has just exploded. It's the fastest growing nonprofit in the world right now. They're expecting, I think, 10 to 12,000 people to attend the conference in Denver, which is their fifth or sixth annual conference. Here you see the number of certified projects. And LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. NC is for new construction, so these are new buildings. They have standards for new buildings, for existing buildings, for core and shell of buildings, for commercial interiors, and also LEED for homes, which is now in a pilot phase and is going to be rolling out later next year. There's 50 states, 13 countries, there's millions of gross square feet of LEED. And you know, we have local chapters here. We have the Redwood Empire chapter, which is our local chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. So as I mentioned earlier, in Principles of Sustainability, I looked at hundreds. I tailored it down to 40 for my book, 40 to 50. And then I started looking at what year they sort of came into existence, what their scope was, whether they were national, international, or regional, what the sector was that was involved in creating them. Was it the government? Was it multi-stake? Was it civil society? And then what the typology is. And by that I meant by looking at, are they really focused more on values or are they focused more on metrics? So for example, ecological footprint is a really, really useful tool, and it's much more metric oriented than it is values oriented. The Minnesota Principles is more values oriented. It's a tool that gives you measurable data, right? So when you look at your own ecological footprint, or the ecological footprint of a city or a region, you know, Sonoma did its own. We're going to do one here for Marin, for the countywide plan. It's a data intensive tool that helps us measure what our impact is. The values are more like, how do we need to be in the world? The ones that combine both of those are the ones that are taking off in the marketplace. You take something like LEED, which has both. The NEP is the Netherlands Environmental Policy Plan, which is their green plan for the whole country. We don't have a green plan here in the U.S. We have green plans for some states, like New Jersey has one, and New Jersey adopted their green plan from the NEP. They use the NEP one. Oregon has one, Minnesota has one as well, and then there's some regional ones that people are working on as well.
What would that include?
Everything from transportation to housing, the whole enchilada, so to speak, education, business, green building. You look at all those things and you say, okay, as a nation, I mean, you can look at it, it's just different scales. As a nation, what are our goals, what are our objectives? You know, the Netherlands plan, which is a classic plan, started looking at how do we attain a quality of life for all the Dutch citizens? What are the kinds of things that we need to be looking at? And they had to deal with it because they're the second most densely populated country in the world. Wouldn't think of that, but it is after Bangladesh. It's because all those problems that they've been dealing with comes from being in such a small place, and they're also, you know, half the country would be underwater if it weren't for the dikes, right? That's keeping the water out there. So they're dependent on this small space, and then they're trying to figure out a lot of resources that are imported into their country. How do we keep our quality of life? And it's, you know, it's got long history. So they're trying to figure out how do we implement these ideas and these principles into daily living. And the other side of it is that in the Dutch culture, the government is seen much more of as a partner. I would say that for Europe in general. Whereas here we say, government, get away from us. There it's not seen necessarily as a threat. So business and government work hand in hand to try and figure out to meet these goals. ICLEI, I'll talk about that in just a little bit. It's a climate, it's an international organization that deals with climate protection. Is one of their biggest programs. It came out of the Rio conference. So let's look at some key themes that weave throughout all of these principles that I was looking at. One is stewardship. I really like this quote of Aldo Leopold, but stewardship to me means our relationship with the natural world and our responsibility towards it. So what is our place in the scheme of the larger sphere, and then how do we deal with it? What is our relationship with the biotic community, if you will? It's not one of dominion per se, but it's one of understanding what our responsibilities are. And many of these principles deal with that whole issue of what is the human role? What is our role? How do we fit in? The next one is respect for limits. You know, we only have one Earth, right? So how do we deal with what it can, how it can sustain us? That graph is from the Footprint Network, Matthias Wagenagel's group in the East Bay, looking at the fact that we're an overshoot, right? So we're consuming more than what this planet can produce. Now you could say we don't really sense that per se, but it's almost like you're driving in a car and you're going 60 miles an hour and the tank is about to run on empty. You don't really know when it's going to run out, but you're still going in overshoot. And that's that. You know, he's doing a lot of work right now with Europe, particularly in doing ecological footprints for countries and for cities. Interdependence. In looking at nature's services, we look at what are the things that nature provides for free? What are the things that we depend on that we don't even think about? Like clean air and water and soils, like pollination that goes on all the time, soil fertilization, pest control. Gretchen Daly down at Stanford has done a lot of work on this. If you want to put a dollar figure on it, Bob Costanza did that. And as the quote says, you know, it's equal to the world's combined GDP. But how do you put a price on clean water and clean air? It's priceless, you know. So, and this slide down below here is the Biosphere 2, which was an attempt, when was it, in the early 90s, I guess, to try and recreate biomes. And there was $200 million was spent on this, and then it didn't work out. It failed. Many of the species in the biomes died, and then there was a leak in the building and air got in. So nature's been doing this for 3.8 billion years, and we try and recreate it with our technology, and we're not always very successful. In New York State, they were going to build a water treatment plant and figured out it was going to be a lot of money to build that. And then they discovered that rather than do that, what would be the cost of protecting the Catskill Mountains watershed, where they get their water anyways. And they figured out it was a lot more economical for them to do that rather than to build a whole power plant down in Manhattan. So again, technology may not always be the quick fix that we need. Economic restructuring, this is a huge one, because this is what we're going through on a daily basis. Stuart Cowan did this map for conservation economy. It looks at the three E's of sustainability: equity, ecology, and economy. And then you start branching out into all of the different sectors of what we need to do to reshape our economy. And in sustainability, I think one of the biggest messages that keeps coming back in my mind is to say that it's all going back to local. That's why Sustainable Fairfax and the groups that are doing here, it all goes back to what is our local economy? You know, there was that event in West Marin a couple months back with Wendell Berry and Michael Pollan on food that they did. And Wendell Berry was talking about the whole mountaintop removal that's going on in Kentucky. And the question was asked, what can we do here in West Marin to help you there in Kentucky? And the answer was, you guys are developing an incredible, viable, local food economy here in West Marin. We need you to keep doing that. We need you to succeed at it, and then you can create a model that other people can emulate. So rather than try and get your speakers to necessarily try and export your wisdom or what you've done or change what we're doing over in Kentucky, keep doing what you're doing here and then see in what ways, once you get it going, once you get all the kinks out of it, see how other communities can adopt that. Stuart Cowan, if you go to conservationeconomy.net, you'll see that model, and it actually is much broader than this. It has slideshows, it has all kinds of things. Stuart worked with Sim Vandrine on a book called Ecological Design, which is one of the classics that universities use for ecological design. Here's more of a close-up of one area, economic capital, and then you look at the bioregional economies. You know, EcoTrust is doing a lot of work in that. I don't know how many of you saw Spencer Beebe's presentation of the Bioneers on EcoTrust, which is a nonprofit out of Portland, looking at the whole Northwest and up into Canada, and they're calling it the Salmon Nation. And the Salmon Nation, salmon being the totem species of that whole region, and the fact that the salmon is now coming back. And so how can we get people really enthusiastic and rally around these species, because that's what really defines that whole region. And the southernmost part of that region is right here. It's San Francisco, and it goes all the way up to Canada and Alaska region, the whole Northwest. And they've done all kinds of work on how to support those communities and those regional economies. Green business, another area, and then local economies. Fair distribution, this is the 2080 statistic that's often quoted. You know, it's interesting. Even a really scientific principle like the natural step, which is a green business sort of guiding framework, the fourth system condition is about equity, which is not a scientific thing, but they realize it is such a critical component that we can't ignore it. And this is one where even Hunter Lovins in her program in San Francisco saying it's really hard to start trying to apply metrics to the social aspects of it. We can get statistics on unemployment and income and all of that, but for the equity part of sustainability, there's a lot of work now trying to be done to see how can we apply some more metrics to that area, to the social component of it. Intergeneration perspective, this is what was in those sustainability definitions, and this is about shifting from quarterly reports that we're so tied into in our business world into more of a 10, 20, 100, 500-year plan. How do we look that far ahead? And how do we... These two images are from the Long Now Foundation, Stuart Brandt, in the East Bay. This is... The first one here is a model of a clock, of a 10,000-year clock that they built. This is in the London Museum. And they actually have a... they're going to build it in Nevada in the desert. And the notion is, how can we start to think in such long term that we think beyond our day-to-day? And what impact will that have in terms of our design processes? How can we start designing our infrastructure, our buildings? You know, you go back to the Craftsman era, or even the cathedrals that would last thousands of years. You know, many of the stuff that we worked on today, whether it's automobiles or homes, whatever, 10 years less? So how do we shift that whole process? The image on the right is the Rosetta Project, which is also from the Long Now Foundation, which is to document and preserve languages from the world. Thousands of languages that we're losing on a daily and weekly basis. I mean, this is just going away because the cultures are going away. What is the value of that, and how can we start preserving that, and how can we learn from that? So that's a lot of very interesting work, very long-term work of the Long Now Foundation. It was actually Bill McDonough who tells this story when he was in a... They were looking at trying to design some signage for nuclear waste in the Hanford Reservation in the state of Washington. and they were trying to figure out how can we design warning signs to let people know 1,000, 10,000 years from now how to not walk in areas where we have nuclear waste. And it, you know, it's a daunting challenge. Maybe English won't be around, who knows, right? So how do you do that with symbols? And the native peoples from up there said, you know, that's not a problem for us. We plan to be here. We'll tell them. So it's, again, it's sort of, what's our perception? You know, they don't plan to go anywhere. Nature as model and teacher really speaks to a lot of the work of Janine Benyus, who's a biologist who's been doing a lot of work on slowing down. The first thing she says is we need to slow down and listen. We need to really slow down and listen to the natural world and then get inspiration from nature. Rather than feel that we take things out of nature, how do we work with it? How do we learn from the 3.8 billion years of evolution to design our systems, whether it be industrial systems, whether it be our businesses, all kinds of design that can be inspired from nature. Bill McDonough, in his book, Cradle to Cradle, same thing. How do we develop a closed-loop system where waste equals food, where we're talking about eco-effectiveness? We could be very efficient, but how can we design systems that are efficient but are also that are appealing? So we know there's certain things that we gravitate towards in buildings. We like natural lighting. We enjoy places that invite people to congregate and talk. You know, when Sim Van der Rijn worked on the project down at De Anza College, one of the things they discovered was that outside of the classrooms, they purposely built these little alcoves, little circles outside of the hallways. And it turns out that that's where a lot of the conversations and a lot of the exchange happens between the students. Simple design idea, but they say, you know, those things have impact. So how to create effective design strategies. Now some bright lights. I'll talk about a few of these. These are, you know, the ICLEI, the Local Governments for Sustainability. Blue Planet Run is a project that's happening as a relay race around the world to promote clean drinking water. And they're going to do it. They're working actually with the people who do the Olympics relay race. And Jin Zeidel is working on that here in the Bay Area. U.S. partnership, I'll go into detail. U.S. Building Council, I mentioned. This is a wine growing industry, and Napa is having international impact because of how to green the wineries. And John Garn worked on a whole manual on greening wineries, and now has become, from the Wine Institute, has become like the standard model that all of the vineyards all over the world are starting to use. Forest Stewardship Council, again, a standard for responsible wood, and the last one is the Center for Regenerative Design that I'll mention. So the U.S. partnership is part of a U.N. program to mainstream sustainability education. That's really the objective. And they have action teams and sector teams. I've been a part of the marketing action team. So what we do is, every several weeks, we get on the telephone and have these phone conferences with people all around the country to figure out how do we begin to get these stories into the mainstream, into CNN, into the networks, into the Newsweeks, into the Time magazine. How do we do that? How do we not replicate? How do we not duplicate what each other is doing? So by having a larger organization like the UN, it also really opens doors for these small groups. It's really interesting how once you say you're aligned yourself with somebody that's a bigger cause that the UN is doing, it tends to open some doors for people to then be able to exchange ideas. The sector teams are, you know, they focus on the business angle, the faith angle, which is exploding right now, higher ed, and then K-12. USpartnership.org is a website for that. ICLEI, the Climate Protection Campaign, is also completely having a huge impact, not only in this country, but around the world. Sonoma County was the first county in the country to have all of their major cities be a part of this program. And it was the work of Ann Hancock, who worked with them. So again, they said, looking at greenhouse gas emissions, look at what they're doing now, then they set a goal, then they set an action plan, then what their measures and policies, and then they monitor them after that. In Marin County, there's our target, 15 to 20% greenhouse gas emissions reduction by 2015, and here are the members of who signed on to date. And you may wonder why MMWD, what does that have to do with climate? Well, it turns out a lot of energy is used in pumping water to different parts of the county, and that's why they're a huge component of this. And here's some of the work that our county's green team is doing out of the Community Development Agency. So they have the Green Building Program that Alec Hoffman is heading, doing fast track permitting. And basically, you know, you can call Alec or call that office and say, I have a question about greening my home, or I need somebody to help me in this, that, and the other. So you can either call Green Fusion or you can call Alec. And they'll direct you. They'll give you. They're a resource there, and it's a great resource to know about. The Green Business Program. I just got these numbers today because they keep changing. That's how many green businesses we have, as of I guess the latest numbers that I got. And that's how many they have in the whole Bay Area, because that's a Bay Area wide program which was started years ago, and it started with garages and with printing factories to deal with like the basic how do we dispose of oil and inks. Well, it since has expanded to all these other areas of businesses. The Marin Solar Program, the Million Solar Roofs has actually just ended, but what they're looking at now is that energy efficiency grant from the CPUC, and that's what they're just starting to work on now. I was just talking to the person there involved with that. And that's our target, and we're more than hit that target. We're really close to hitting it now, actually, so we're way ahead of the curve on that. And then the county, of course, has its own rebates, as well as the CEC has a rebate as well. So the Center for Regenerative Design, this was a center that we started at the beginning of this year, and I'm working on it with Sim Vandrine, who's an architect here in Marin. And our objective is to advance sustainability education by working with these different groups, the College of Marin, Dominican University, the county, and then local organizations, either for-profit and non-profit. And we want to integrate sustainability into education. So, for example, we're going to have Jeff Chase, who has been traveling around the country, meeting with faculty and administration to figure out how they can incorporate sustainability into their courses. And he's going to be coming to College of Marin, meeting with the faculty there and giving them ideas on how to incorporate that. And then we'll also be looking at certificate degree programs. And these 10 systems is on our website. We actually have these listed, and we'll go into more depth detailing them. But these are the systems that you can look at in a green campus, but they actually apply to any community of the things that we need to be looking at: energy, water, the built environment, material resources, waste, food, land regeneration, transportation, health and well-being. These are sort of, you know, when you were saying, you know, what does the green plan entail? These are the things. These are kind of like, here's the menu of all the areas that we need to be looking at. And so that's what we're looking at in terms of the higher ed arena. And this is my final slide to invite all of you to just take a dive and dive in, because there's so many opportunities. I mean, when I think of Marin and where we are here, what are the biggest assets that we have? Well, one is innovation. We have tremendous innovation going on here. We have, you know, the talent and the people that we have in the Bay Area is world leaders in this area. You have PAC Scientific, you know, in Sausalito, that is doing huge work in developing new designs for fan technology. You have Paul Hawken doing his work in cataloging all of the different groups, right, with the civil society work. You have all of the nonprofits in here. So I think that one of the things that we definitely can contribute is the innovation, the ideas, and then spread them beyond the Bay Area. I mean, we're in one of the hotspots here. So I think that's it. Thank you. If there are questions, yeah, sure. Yeah, Scott.
You talked about the 20% by 2020 with the greenhouse emission reductions. Can you talk a bit about what they did for the state? I know Schwarzenegger signed in a commitment to also reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Do you know much about that?
I don't. I just know that, I mean, there's efforts going on at the state level, at the regional level, and at the local level. And when I said all goes back to local, I believe that the more we're able to, at the local level, start generating actions, then they'll trickle up just as much as they'll trickle down. So even though the leadership at the higher levels can make it go faster, I think that we can still, it's both ways. So, I mean, Schwarzenegger, I mean, I'm far-sighted in thinking about this. And, you know, even with the green building arena, we're really moving forward in terms of making LEED silver for all government buildings and trying to set these standards. But the more we can get locally, we can move way ahead. So I wouldn't wait too much for the higher levels to make it happen, because we could be waiting a long time. And, you know, administrations shift and change over time. But if we can get it going at the local level, look at what Willits is doing in their own community and setting their own example. City Repair, that we had the speaker come in last week in Portland, setting the local piazzas and the local intersections. And they just said, all of you got the community to come together without an agenda. They said, let's just have tea. Let's just get people to know their neighbors. And then from there, it's exploded into this whole movement that's been happening in Portland. I think they have 60 areas now where they've decorated all these street intersections in downtown Portland. I'd love to see that here. You know, maybe we'll do that.